All right, y'all. Go ahead and find a spot if you haven't already. Can y'all hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, awesome. Okay, so thank you everyone for coming. This is our third Theology Night session on C.S. Lewis. And as usual, we have drinks and snacks in the back. We actually have some hot water for tea if anybody would like some. So thank you, Dana, for getting all that together. So last week, Kimball shared with us about the Narnia volume, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But I think best of all, he read a section of the novel, I should say, to us. And I think it's safe to say that he had all of us pretty enchanted. But tonight, we're going to turn to another book in the Narnia series, The Magician's Nephew. And so before we do that, as we always do, though, let's begin our evening with a blessing before we welcome up Kimball. So go ahead and bow your heads and pray with me. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our God, we firmly believe that you are present here, and we humbly adore you in union with the angels and saints. We love you above all things and with our whole hearts. We offer you all that we are and all that we have, our souls with all their faculties, our bodies with all their senses. Enlighten our understanding and inflame our wills, that we may know and do what is pleasing to you. We ask you to direct all the powers of our souls, all our thoughts and affections to your service and your glory, as well as to our own sanctification and salvation. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. All right, and with that, let's welcome up Kimball.
Well, thank you, Zach, and welcome back. Another packed audience for the assembly. There's standing room only here. We're going to talk a little bit about bait and switch initially, because we may not get to the magician's nephew tonight, even though that's what this session was advertised, because last time there was a lot of thought and questions about biographical information. Who was C.S. Lewis? What was his life like? How did his experience influence his writings? So that's really going to be the primary focus of our discussion tonight. We're not advancing. Oh, because we're not on. There we go. So just a quick overview of Lewis, and then I'll get into some pretty substantive detail of his life, which I hope you find interesting. Lewis was born Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. You can see why he was C.S. Lewis. Clive Staples Lewis was born in Ulster in Northern Ireland in the city of Belfast, November 29, 1898. He died on November 22, 1963, 1 week before his 65th birthday. Some of you may remember that date for another reason. He was a British writer and an Anglican lay theologian. He held academic positions in English literature at both Oxford University, Magdalen College, and Cambridge University, Magdalen College, spelled differently. There's an E at the end of Magdalen at Cambridge. And Magdalen is spelled M-A-G-D-A-L-E-N. But for some reason, they pronounce it Magdalen. So that's a useful bit of trivia for you. He's written more than 30 books, translated into more than 30 languages, sold millions, millions of copies. Best known as author of the Narnia Chronicles and other works of fiction, such as the Screwtape Letters, the Space Trilogy, and nonfiction Christian apologetics, including Mere Christianity, which we discussed in the first session, Miracles, The Abolition of Man, The Problem of Pain, and many, many others. Chronicles of Narnia have sold the most and have been popularized on stage, TV, radio, and cinema. And Mere Christianity was voted the best book of the 20th century by Christianity Today in the year 2000. And Lewis, as we've referenced before, was a close friend of J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings. Both men served on the English faculty at Oxford University and were active in an informal Oxford literary group known as the Inklings. We'll talk about them a little bit. But what one might surmise from the name of their group that they were starting to gain an inkling of wisdom in their communication and time together. At least that's what I think it means. Regarding Tolkien, Lewis wrote that my friendship with Tolkien, whom he nicknamed Tollers, marked the breakdown of two prejudices. At my first coming into the world as an Irish member of the Anglican Church, I had been implicitly warned never to trust a papist. I mean, this is Northern Ireland versus the Catholics in Southern Ireland. And at my first coming into the English faculty, explicitly, never to trust a philologist, someone studying words. And Tolkien was both, and yet he turned out to be one of his best friends. Lewis's 1955 memoir, Surprised by Joy, in that he states he was baptized in the Church of Ireland, but fell away during his adolescence. We'll get into some of the reasons why. He returned to Anglicanism at the age of 32, owing in large part to the influence of Tolkien and other friends, and he became what he described as an ordinary layman of the Church of England. He never claimed to have any particular wisdom or authority about church teachings, just a regular old ordinary layman. His faith profoundly affected his work and his wartime radio broadcasts on the subject of Christianity, which we all know was mere Christianity, brought him worldwide acclaim. His philosophical writings are widely cited by Christian scholars from many denominations. I think that his concept of mere Christianity as opposed to something Anglican or Catholic or Methodist or some other group distinguished him in that regard and made him accessible. And people would listen to him in part because he wasn't tribal in his descriptions of what Christianity meant. A few of the details about Lewis and his family. His father was Albert James Lewis, born in 1863. He died in 1929. He was a solicitor. Solicitors in England are the ones who have clients, and if cases go to trial, a barrister is brought in and the solicitor hires the barrister, a little different than our system here. Regarding his father, Lewis said the following: my father belonged to the first generation of his family that reached professional station. His grandfather had been a Welsh farmer. His father, a self-made man, had begun life as a workman, emigrated to Ireland, and ended as a partner in a firm of boilermakers, engineers, and iron shipbuilders. His mother, Florence Augusta Lewis, known as Flora, was the daughter of Thomas Hamilton, a Church of Ireland priest, and the great-grandfather or great-granddaughter of both Bishop Hugh Hamilton and John Staples. That's where the Staples came from. His mother's blood went all the way back to a Norman knight whose bones lay in the Battle Abbey. Of his father and mother, Lewis said, the two families from which I spring were as different in temperament as in origin. My father's people were true Welshmen, sentimental, passionate, rhetorical, easily moved both to anger and tenderness, men who laughed and cried a great deal and who had not much of a talent for happiness. The Hamiltons, his mother's side, were a cooler race. Their minds were cryptical, critical, ironic, and they had the talent of happiness in high degree. They went straight for it, as experienced travelers go for the best seat in a train. From my earliest years, I was aware of the vivid contrast between my mother's cheerful and tranquil affection and the ups and downs of my father's emotional life. As this spread in me, long before I was old enough to give it a name, a certain distrust or dislike of emotion as something uncomfortable and embarrassing and even dangerous. Both my parents, by the standards of that time and place, were bookish or clever people. Lewis had one older brother, Warren Hamilton Lewis, whom he called Warney. And of Warney, he said, though 3 years my senior, he never seemed to be an elder brother. We were allies, not to say confederates, from the first period. Yet we were very different. Our earliest pleasures, and I can remember no time when we were not incessantly drawing, reveal it. His were of ships and trains and battles. Mine, when not imitated from his, were of what we both called dressed animals, the anthropomorphized beasts of nursery literature, animals dressed up as humans. When Lewis's pet dog, Jaxie, was killed by a car, the four-year-old Lewis adopted the name Jaxie, and at first he would answer to no other name, but later accepted Jack, the name by which he was known to friends and families for the rest of his life. So nobody called him C.S. Lewis, they just called him Jack. In 1905, when he was seven, the first great change in their life took place when they, what he calls, we moved house. This was called Little Leah, where they moved to. My father, he says, growing, I suppose, in prosperity, decided to leave the semi-detached villa in which I'd been born and built himself a much larger house farther out into what was then the country. The new house, as we continued for years to call it, was a large one, even by my present standards. To a child, it seemed less like a house than a city. My father, who had more capacity for being cheated than any man I have ever known, was badly cheated by his builders. The drains were wrong, the chimneys were wrong, there was a draft in every room. None of that, however, mattered to me as a child. To me, the important thing about the move was that the background of my life became larger. The new home is almost a major character in my story. I'm a product of long corridors, empty sunlit rooms, upstairs indoor silences, attics explored in solitude, distant noises of gurgling cisterns and pipes, and the noise of wind under the tiles. The house was filled with books. Every house should be filled with books. Nothing was forbidden to me. In the seemingly endless rainy afternoons, I took volume after volume from the shelves. I always had the same certainty of finding a book that was new to me as a man who walks in a field has of finding a new blade of grass. Later, he continues, my brother was packed off to school and thus removed from my life for the greater part of every year. My real life, or what my memory reports is my real life, was increasingly one of solitude. What drove me to write was the extreme manual clumsiness from which I've always suffered. I attribute it to a physical defect which my brother and I both inherit from our father. We have only one joint in the thumb. The upper joint, that furthest from the nail, is visible, but it's a mere sham, and we can't bend it. Not too interesting, but, you know. Lewis describes, yeah, I can't believe it, imagine. He describes, Diane, this is what I was talking about. He describes the concept of the sense of what he called joy as a mystical, evanescent, and ephemeral longing. So I got to warn you, you got to pause here, because what we're drifting into is something that's really difficult to grasp, I think, and you really have to wrestle with. It's in some respects the most intriguing, reflective, and difficult discussion about Lewis. The discussion relates to the meaning of joy. And it has a particular meaning for him. And in a way, it's kind of an unstated example of his concept of looking along the beam, where you stop looking at something and you start becoming a part of it. There's subtle undertones of those threads that are woven into his reflections in some of his more thoughtful works, The Weight of Glory and The Problem of Pain, of the definitions of good and evil, the meaning of life. And in an ontological way, the science of being, a longing for and an explanation of the experience of being. So this is what he calls joy. He's relating joy to sort of somehow understanding the essence of life. These are reminiscent also of sometimes in scripture where we run into paradoxes and perplexing things that force us to stretch our minds and our imagination to understand. Descriptions contained in the accounts of Genesis, or St. Stephen, as he's about to be stoned, saying, "I see the heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." The futuristic five end times visions of Daniel, the apocalyptic images of John in the book of Revelation. In the final words of joy, "It is finished," that Jesus utters as he gives up his spirit in the final moment of life, juxtaposing and mixing that ultimate humiliation with the ultimate triumph, that there's a sense of joy in both suffering and joy at the same time. The prophetic visions of Ezekiel, the dreams of Joseph, there are other scriptural examples you might think of. All these things undergird our understanding of life. And this is where Lewis talked about you need to really wrestle with these things to get what he was trying to talk about. And these are thoughts that he had in the nursery when he was young, as he's reflecting. So what does Lewis mean by joy? He cites three surprising and memorable experiences, and I'm not going to talk much more about them. I've given you my introduction and spin on them, and hope you can sort of look for some of these things as we slide into them. So he says, at the ages of 6 to 7 and 8, I was living almost entirely in my imagination, or at least that the imaginative experience of those years now seems to me more important than anything else. My invented world was full for me of interest, bustle, humor, and character, but there was no poetry and no romance in it. It was almost astonishingly prosaic. I had three major experiences. The first, I was standing beside a flowering currant bush on a summer day. There suddenly arose in me without warning, and as if from a depth not of years but of centuries, the memory of that earlier morning at the old house when my brother had brought his toy garden into the nursery. It's difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation which came over me. It was a sensation, of course, of desire, but desire for what? Not certainly for a biscuit tin filled with moss, nor even, though that came into it, for my own past. And before I knew what I desired, the desire itself was gone. The whole glimpse withdrawn. The world turned commonplace again, or only stirred by a longing for the longing that had just ended. It had taken only a moment in time, and a certain sense that everything that else that had ever happened to me was insignificant in comparison. Maybe that first memory is about creation, the pretend world that his brother had created, the link with that and how God created the universe, a connection with God himself. I don't know what he was wrestling with. The second glimpse, as difficult as the first, came through the Beatrix Potter book, The Tale of Squirrel Nutkin, but not really from the book itself, It just administered the shock. It was a trouble. It troubled me with what I can only describe as the idea of autumn. It sounds fantastic to say that one can be enamored of a season, but that's something like what happened. And as before, the experience was one of intense desire. And one went back to the book not to gratify the desire. That was impossible. How can one possess autumn? But to reawaken. And in this experience also, there was the same surprise and the same sense of incalculable importance. It was something quite different from ordinary life and even from ordinary pleasure. Something, as they would now say, in another dimension. So maybe this one was a glimpse into the meaning of time, the harvest of life that comes in the autumn, a prelude to death, the September years. I don't know. The third glimpse came through poetry. I had become fond of Longfellow's Saga of King Olaf, fond of it in a casual, common, shallow way for its stories and its vigorous rhythms, but then quite different from such pleasures, and like a voice from far more distant regions, there came a moment when I idly turned the pages of the book and found the unrhymed translation of Tegner's Drapa. I'm sure we've all read that. And I read, I heard a voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead. I knew nothing about Balder, but instantly I was uplifted into the huge regions of the northern sky. I desired with almost sickening intensity something never to be described, except that it is cold, spacious, severe, pale, and remote. And then, as in the other examples, I find myself at the very same moment already falling out of that desire and wishing I were back in it. Maybe that one's a glimpse of the enormity of the universe, where we go when we die, what it means to be separated from our physical body. But regardless, to emphasize the importance of these perplexing experiences, Lewis says, the reader who finds these three episodes of no interest need read this book no further. For in a sense, the central story of my life is about nothing else. Now, for those who are still disposed to read, I will only underline the quality common to all three experiences. It's that of an unsatisfied desire, which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. I call it joy, which is here a technical term, and must be sharply distinguished from both happiness and pleasure. Joy, in my sense, has indeed one characteristic and only one in common with those, the fact that anyone who has experienced it will want it again. Apart from that, and considered only in its quality, joy might almost equally well be called a particular kind of unhappiness or grief. But then, it is a kind of want. I doubt whether anyone who has ever tasted it would ever, if both were in his power, exchange it for all the pleasures of the world. But then joy is never in our power, and pleasures often are. So I put that out there for your reflection and thought. Surprised by joy, you can read about it yourself and see if you can learn from it something more substantive. But to Lewis, it was the looking along the beam. It was the key to that unlocks the mystery of his life. But Lewis was about to experience a sudden turn for the worse in his life. His mother suddenly took ill and died in 1908 from cancer. This was a major event in his life and personality development. With the death of his mother, his world was catapulted upside down. Lewis describes the experience as the great loss which befell our family. There came a night when I was ill and crying, both with headache and toothache, and distressed because my mother did not come to me. And that was because she was ill too. And what was odd was that there were several doctors in her room and voices and comings and goings all over the house and doors shutting and opening. It seemed to last for hours. And then my father, in tears, came into my room and began to try to convey to my terrified mind things it had never conceived before. It was, in fact, cancer, and it followed the usual course. An operation — they operated in the patient's house in those days — an apparent convalescence, a return of the disease, increasing pain, and death. My father never fully recovered from this loss. I'm not sure Lewis ever did it either. Lewis's father, who had sometimes been described as distant, demanding, and eccentric — we talked about before his not having much humor in his life — unable to care for the children without his wife being there and continue on his practice as a lawyer, sent both his children off to the Wynyard School in Watford, Hertfordshire, in England. So they were from Northern Ireland, and now they're shipped across the water to England. While other students — and this was a hellhole of a school — the headmaster's name was Robert Capron, and the schoolboys nicknamed him Oldie, and he was physically abusive to these boys. But Lewis himself, according to Warney, had the good fortune of being kind of a teacher's pet, because he amused Oldie, the boy's nickname for Capron, and because of that, Lewis avoided much of the personal pain that was inflicted on some of the other students, but he witnessed it, and he was appalled by it. He frequently wrote to his father begging him to be released from what he called this prison, which was the school, and which he later called Belsen, after the German concentration camp in World War II. His brother Warney's personality was also profoundly and negatively affected by that experience. Warney had been there for 3 years before Lewis himself went. And for much of his life, Warney suffered from alcoholism, which may have been attributed, at least in part, to those experiences as a child. Lewis's father pulled him out of the school, and not long after the Lewises left, the school was closed due to a lack of pupils. Imagine that. And Oldie eventually found his way into an insane asylum. After a short time, after Lewis is growing older now, and after he left Wynyard, he went to Campbell College in the east of Belfast, about a mile from his home, but he experienced respiratory problems. He went back to England for a period of time. He had some tutors. And after his experiences at Wynyard, he thought, well, if only I pray, and I pray fervently, that's going to make things right. And he did, and he was devoted in his prayer, and nothing seemed to happen. He started to view prayer as a chore and a duty. And then he became interested in the occult, and it was at this period of time that he lost his faith. If and when we get to the magician's nephew, Uncle Andrew, the villainous character, is likened in part to Oldie, and also his dabbling in the occult arts was similar to what Lewis later came to reject in his experiences during this period of his life. He described his young self as paradoxically both being very angry with God for not existing and equally angry with God for creating the world. He was somehow able to share both those thoughts at the same time. During this period, he was also, as he had been younger, just entranced with northernness, what he and his brother called Icelandic, Scandinavian, Norse mythology. They just loved those stories. And he continued to love nature, and the beauty of nature reminded him of the stories of the North, and the stories of North reminded him of the beauties of nature. So it was a do loop. In his teenage writings, he moved away from the tales of boxen B-O-X-E-N, which was the imaginary world that he and Warnie had created and would play in together for hours. And he began experimenting with different art forms such as epic poetry and opera to try to somehow capture his newfound interest in Norse mythology and the natural world. He worked with a tutor named Kirkpatrick, and he developed a love of Greek literature, mythology, that sharpened his debate and reasoning skills. The name Kirkpatrick, we're told, is condensed in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to be Professor Kirke, K-I-R-K-E. And Kirke, of course, in German is church. And so Lewis, you know, with his association with Tolkien, came to love words and to play with words and to hide things in the words. And that's something I've talked about Michael Ward and the Narnia Code. That's a theme that Ward builds upon in his discovery of what he thinks was going on in the Narnia Chronicles. So in 1916, he was awarded a scholarship at University College in Oxford. He became particularly fond of the poet Yeats, partly because of his use of Ireland's Celtic heritage in his poetry, and partly because he was Irish. In fact, Lewis loved the Irish. He was very proud of being Irish. And describing an encounter with a fellow Irishman, he wrote, "Like all Irish people who meet in England, we ended by criticisms of the invincible flippancy and dullness of the Anglo-Saxon race." Kind of appropriate for our recent celebration of St. Patrick's Day, right? It says, "After all, there's no doubt that the Irish are the only people. With all their faults, I would not gladly live or die among any other folk." There are some who say that Lewis's dismay over the conflict between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, between the Catholics and the Protestants, was a part of what caused him to eventually adopt an ecumenical brand of Christianity that we experienced in mere Christianity. And he wanted to heal that rift. He wanted his homeland to be united again. He extolled the virtues of all branches of Christian faith, emphasizing a need for unity among Christians around a term that we know as mere Christianity that was originally not coined by Lewis, was attributed to Reverend Richard Baxter from the 17th century and was also picked up by C.K. Chesterton, another Catholic convert. So Lewis entered Oxford in the 1917 term, studying at University College. And, of course, we're in the middle of World War I at that point, 1917. And he joined the Officers' Training Corps as the most promising route into the Army. He was drafted into a cadet battalion for training and later commissioned into the 3rd Battalion of the Somerset Light Infantry of the British Army as a second lieutenant. And within months of entering Oxford, he was shipped by the British Army to France to fight in World War I. He experienced life in the trenches, just a horrible, if you can imagine, the death, the smells, the wet mud that you're living in. You're never dry, you're always cold. More people are dying, or as many by illness as by fire. I mean, it's just a horrible, hellish existence. And on his 19th birthday, November 29, 1917, he arrived at the front lines in the Somme Valley in France. On April 15, just 4 or 5 months later, in the midst of the German spring offensive, he was seriously wounded, not by the Germans, but by a British shell that fell short of its intended target and killed 2 of his colleagues. He was seriously injured himself by the shrapnel and sent home to convalesce. It took him a while to recover. he was depressed, as you might imagine, during that period of time. He'd lost his faith. He'd lost his friends. He'd suffered horribly. Life didn't make sense. It was a horrible, terrible period for him. And he'd lost his mother. And all of those losses contributed to his feelings of pessimism and atheism. But he made his way back to college, back to Magdalen, and he excelled as a student. He accomplished an incredible feat of a triple first in one semester, which was just really quite extraordinary, receiving simultaneously the highest honors in three areas of study. I mean, the man was a genius. He became a philosophy tutor at University College and subsequently was elected a fellow and tutor at Magdalen College, where he served for 29 years. Janie Moore. Who was Janie Moore? Well, during his Army training, Lewis had shared a room with another cadet, Edward Courtney Francis Patty Moore. And Maureen Moore, Patty's sister, said that Lewis and Patty made a mutual pact that if either died during the war, the survivor would take care of both of their families. Patty was killed in action in 1918, and Lewis dutifully kept his part of the bargain and fulfilled his promise. Janie Moore was Patty's mother. Patty had introduced Lewis to his mother when Lewis was 18 and Janie was 45. The friendship of Janie Moore was particularly important to Lewis. His father never visited him when he was in the hospital convalescing, but Janie did. Janie was there almost all the time. And she moved in with Lewis. She lived with him and Warney until she was hospitalized in the late 40s. Lewis routinely introduced Janie as his mother and referred to her as such in letters and developed a deeply affectionate friendship with her, in part filling the void left by the death of his own mother. There are some who say their relationship was something substantially more than platonic, but others dispute those assertions, and I'm not sure that we need to spend a lot of time there. In 1930, Lewis, Warney, Mrs. Moore, and her daughter Maureen moved into the Kilns. The Kilns was a house in the district of Headington Quarry on the outskirts of Oxford that's now a part of Risinghurst. All the residents contributed financially to the purchase of the house, which eventually passed to Maureen, who by then was Dame Maureen Dunbar when Warren died in 1973. Moore developed dementia in her later years and was eventually moved into a nursing home where she died in 1951. As Lewis had done for him, as Janie had done for him while he was recovering from his war wounds, Lewis visited Janie almost every day in the nursing home until her death. Lewis's return to Christianity. During his period of atheism, Lewis was of the view that had God really designed the world, it would not be a world so frail and faulty as the one we see. Interestingly, I think, and with greater prescience, he took the opposite view in Mere Christianity and other writings, saying it's precisely what one would expect of a real world, not an artificial world that was perfect in every way, but something substantive and imperfect. Lewis's fascination was with imaginative writing was heavily influenced by the Scottish writer George MacDonald. And MacDonald was one of the catalysts, along with Tolkien, who helped turn him away from atheism and back into Christianity. George MacDonald, look up MacDonald. I When I read about that, I started reading his fairy tales and some of his other writings, and it's absolutely fascinating imaginative writings. He has shadows that are alive. He has, it's just, I mean, it's the sort of thing that people who go on LSD trips talk about. I mean, he's writing imaginatively in this way that just, it's just stupefying its originality. It's just extraordinary. So really, pick up some George MacDonald's fairy tales is a good place to start. Lewis's appreciation for MacDonald can be particularly seen in a passage in The Great Divorce. Next time, we're going to try to cover both Magician's Nephew and the Great Divorce if we can, but if we don't, I wanted to make sure to introduce this. So as Lewis is, who's a kind of autobiographical character in The Great Divorce, is making his way up the mountain toward heaven, he has a guide. And the guide is identified as George MacDonald. And when he meets MacDonald in heaven, this is how he describes the experience. "I tried, trembling, to tell this man that all his writings had done for me. I tried to tell how a certain frosty afternoon at Leatherhead Station, when I had first bought a copy of Phantastes, being about then a 16-year-old, had been to me what the first sight of Beatrice had been to Dante. Here begins the new life. I started to confess how long that life had delayed in the region of imagination merely, how slowly and reluctantly I had come to admit that his Christendom had more than an accidental connection with it, how hard I had tried not to see the true name of the quality which first met me in his books, holiness." Lewis's return to Christianity wasn't a sudden thing. It happened gradually and over time, and not without staunch resistance on his part. Tolkien would engage in jousting arguments with Lewis about religion. And Lewis resisted and fought in those conversations, so much so that they were, the two enjoyed the spirited work and respected each other's intellect, but they were spirited debates. And, you know, we all had experience of debating with someone who has a different perspective, and it's so easy to just walk away and say, all right, you know, you could have your ridiculous ideas. I know what truth is. But they tried to, you know, prove it to me. Lewis vigorously resisted conversion, noting, this is the way he describes his being brought into Christianity like a prodigal. He says, "I was kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting my eyes in every direction for a chance to escape." He just didn't want to admit it. "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen College, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him," meaning God, "whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me in the Trinity term of 1929. I gave in and admitted that God was God. And I knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England." But that was just a conversion to theism. That was just to believe in God. He wasn't a Christian. That was 1929. He didn't become a Christian until 1931. And that conversion seems to have occurred in large part in a long discussion late one night along Addison's Walk, not far from Oxford, with his close friends Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, one another of the Inklings. And during that time, they were talking about mythology, and Dyson and Tolkien pointed out to him how much he loved Norse mythology, Greek mythology, Roman mythology, Hindu mythology. But when it came to Christian stories, he couldn't, to use the analogy we've been talking about, look along the beam. He could only look at it. And he looked at it in terms of a bunch of rules and kinds of behavior that were really unpleasant, and he just wouldn't think about it in the same way he thought about those other religions. And why? Those other myths. Why not? Why don't you think about Christianity in that same way? And it was like a light bulb turning on to him. And all of a sudden, instead of rejecting all of what we see along the beam of Christianity, he started embracing it. And it was transforming to him. He said when he realized how he'd been blinded by his prejudicial perspective, it all opened up to him in a new and inviting way. He talks about his actual conversion to Christianity as occurring on a motorcycle ride, where he was in the little side passenger seat, his brother Warney was driving, and he says he was on his way to the zoo with his brother, and when he started out, he was not a Christian, but by the time they arrived, he was. That was the way his mind worked. He became a member of the Church of England, somewhat to the disappointment of Tolkien, who'd hoped that he would join the Catholic Church. Joseph Pierce has a long discussion of why Lewis never became a Catholic, but we don't have time for that tonight. But I think a big part of it was he was from Northern Ireland, and the trouble between the North and the South, it was just too big a leap for him to become Catholic. But so he was high Anglican in terms of his senses, but just as a common layman in the Anglican Church. He's been called by many to be the apostle of the skeptics due to both his initial skepticism of the faith, followed by his spirited and innovative apologetical approach to evangelization once he was converted. But as I've said, he considered himself an entirely orthodox Anglican to the end of his life, reflecting that he had initially attended church only to receive communion and had been repelled by the hymns and the poor quality of the sermons. But he later came to consider himself honored by worshiping with men of faith who came in shabby clothes and work boots, but who sang all the verses to all the hymns. They had a faith that he respected. So like his reflections on joy and his conversion to Christianity, all of that gave him an inkling into what is truth. You remember our first question, what is truth? I think all of his efforts at and why there was a sense of joy was this sense in his heart of touching the truth, even just for a second. And the truth is not just warmth and pleasure. It's everything. God's reign falls on the just and the unjust. It's everything. It's the essence of being. So he had an inkling into it. So who were the inklings? We've talked about the inklings. Well, they were a circle of literary friends, and it became an informal discussion society known by the name of the Inklings, which was actually an earlier Oxford organization that broke up of students, and so they sort of adopted that name, but it suited their purpose quite well. There were no formal rules or bylaws of membership in the club or how the meeting would be run. It really was only loosely would be called a club. It was just some people who showed up on Thursday night. You could come whenever you wanted, but you couldn't come any later than 10:30. That was too late. That would have been disrespectful. There were as many as 19 members of the Inklings over the years. Some came and went. When someone was going to propose a new member, they all had to kind of talk about it. Well, you know, is this person going to fit or not? They had to have an incisive, thoughtful, reflective, imaginative mind. That was really what they were most interested in. They all happened to be men, but I don't think that was by design. I think that was by happenstance. They had their own private room in the Eagle and Child. They referred to the Eagle and Child sometimes as the bird and the baby, or sometimes just the bird. Sometimes they'd play games. One of the games was, well, let me back up. What they would do, what the routine was, they were all writers. That was another thing. If you're going to be one of the Inklings, you had to write your own stuff. And then they'd be sitting there drinking beer, pints of beer, and you had to read what you had written. And then you were subjected to the critique of those assembled. Some of the brightest minds in England at the time. And so the critique was, I'm sure, invaluable. In fact, it said Tolkien didn't really like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or The Magician's Nephew. Apparently, Lewis almost cashiered and threw the manuscript away because Tolkien didn't like it. But then he thought and he listened to what it was. And it wasn't so much that Tolkien didn't like the story. It was just he was telling the story in a different kind of way than the seriousness of The Lord of the Rings. There's no narrator. There's no Father Christmas. There's no in and out connection, no asides. I think it was that kind of aspect of it that Tolkien didn't like. It wasn't that he didn't like the story or the meaning behind the story. So the normal agenda was for someone to read their latest work. But if no one had anything to read, well, they're all there drinking beer and they're going to have some fun. So one of the games they played was, let's see who can read notoriously bad prose the longest without laughing. That was their idea of fun. At times, Lewis and Tolkien were known to brashly quaff a pint or two before their scheduled Oxford lectures during their Tuesday noon meetings, but we don't talk about that a lot. So those were the Inklings. There's a lot you can read about the Inklings, and it's fun to do so. Second World War broke out in 1939. And the Lewises took child evacuees from London and other cities into the kilns. If in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, remember how they left London and went out into the country to be with the professor in the great big house, Lewis's great big house with long corridors and places to hide and imaginative things. And that Professor Kirk from Kirkpatrick, who was also Diggory Kirk in The Magician's Nephew, is all connected in these stories. They're all woven together. And like the children going to that home in the outskirts of London, three girls came and stayed at the kilns in 1939, Margaret, Mary, and Catherine. I don't know too much about them. But the movement of women and children out of London to get them away from the Blitz was called Operation Pied Piper. Lewis was only 40 when World War II began, and that was young enough to still be in the military. And he tried to re-enter military service, offering to instruct cadets, but the offer was not accepted. He was asked by the recruiting officers to write newspaper columns for the Ministry of Information, but Lewis declined, not wanting to be forced to write lies, as he described it, to deceive the enemy. He later served in the Home Guard in Oxford. That's not him, but an illustration of a member of the Home Guard. And it was during this time, from 1941 to 43, that he prepared and delivered the broadcasts for the BBC that were called religious broadcasts while the city was enduring periodic air raids. And those broadcasts were collected, as we've said, into Mere Christianity. They were appreciated not only but by the civilians, but by the military as well. Air Chief Marshal Sir Donald Hardiman wrote, "The war, the whole of life, everything tended to seem pointless. We needed, many of us, a key to the meaning of the universe." And Lewis provided just that. King George VI, in December 1951, named Lewis on his last list of honors as a commander of the Order of the British Empire, CBE. Again, Lewis declined. He didn't want to be associated with anything political. Lewis accepted a chair at Cambridge University. He had been discriminated against at Oxford, in part because of his mere Christianity and his not affirming things in a more traditional way. But Cambridge was more open to him and his approach, and they gave him a status that he didn't enjoy at Oxford. But he kept his home at the Kilns, and he returned on weekends until his death in 1963. Has anyone seen the movie The Shadowlands? That's one. It's my one you might want to look up on Netflix or somewhere. I don't know where you get it. Xfinity, Comcast. Later in life, Lewis received correspondence from lots of people, and he tried personally to answer every letter, which really became quite a burden for him, but he dutifully, it was a calling he felt he had, and he dutifully tried to do. And one of the letters came from a woman named Joy Davidman Gresham. She was an American writer of Jewish heritage. She was a former communist, but later converted to Christianity. But her husband was alcoholic and abusive, and in 1952, she fled from him in America to England with her two sons, David and Douglas. And she, having read Lewis's works and known about him, looked him up. She went to the bird, walked in at the appropriate time, and says, "Is anybody here know Lewis? Where's Lewis?" And she ultimately met him, and part of her brash personality and transparent openness to what was true about her in all its beauty and ugliness was attractive to Lewis, because there was something real about her that drew her to him. He viewed her as an agreeable intellectual companion, and she rapidly became a personal friend. But she was an American with a visa, and her ability to stay in England was coming to an end. And so Lewis agreed to enter into a civil marriage contract with her so that she could continue to live in England. And they were married on April 23, 1956. Lewis's brother Warney wrote, "For Jack, the attraction was at first undoubtedly intellectual. Joy, surprised by joy," his autobiography, "Joy," we've talked about the meaning of joy, Joy Gresham. Again, you see the wordplay of Lewis. Joy was the only woman whom he had met who had a brain which matched his own in suppleness, in width of interest, and in analytical grasp, and above all, in humor and a sense of fun. One day, David Min Joy complained of a painful hip, and she was diagnosed, here it is again, with terminal bone cancer. And during their time together, the relationship between Joy and Lewis developed and deepened to a point that they sought a truly Christian marriage, not just a civil marriage. They fell in love. But because she had been divorced, marriage in the Church of England at the time wasn't easy to accomplish. But they had a friend, Reverend Peter Bide, who performed the ceremony at her hospital bed. She thought she was going to die in the Churchill Hospital on March 21, 1957, not quite a year after they became married civilly. Interestingly, after the marriage, her cancer suddenly and blissfully went into remission. She returned to the Kilns, where they lived happily together as a family until 1960, when the cancer returned. And Joy died on July 13 in 1960. The Shadowlands that I mentioned is an account of their time together. Sir Anthony Hopkins plays Lewis, and Deborah Winger is Joy Grisham. I want to watch it again. We haven't seen it for about 20 years. Earlier that year, the couple took a brief holiday in Greece in the Aegean. And although Lewis was fond of walking around in the Oxford area, he hated travel. And this trip marked his only crossing of the English Channel after 1918. Lewis, when Joy died, struggled with the loss, and he captured it in a writing called A Grief Observed. He didn't want to be associated with the book, so he published it under, in large part because it was so raw and so personal and so transparent, that he wanted to talk about, to not have it be linked to him, so that people wouldn't think about it as being about him, but would just think about dealing with grief in a more abstract way. So to avoid detection, he wrote the work, and it was published under the name N.W. Clerk, or Clark, as the British would say. And I'm sure there was a reason for that choice. Just as all the words, there was a reason for every word that he chose. But it kept readers from associating the book with him. Ironically, many of Lewis's friends who were wanting to help him deal with his grief recommended the book to him as something that might be helpful. And with typical mystical cheek, he politely thanked them for their suggestion. After his death, the authorship was made public by the publisher with the permission of the executors of his estate. Lewis continued to raise Joy's two sons after her death. One became a Christian, like Lewis and his mother, but the other, David, returned to his mother's ancestral faith, becoming Orthodox Jewish in his beliefs. On July 15, 1963, Lewis fell ill and was hospitalized. He suffered a heart attack at 5 o'clock p.m. the next day and lapsed into a coma. But he unexpectedly woke up the next day at 2 o'clock and was discharged from the hospital. He went home. He went back to the Kilns. Though he was too ill to return to work, he resigned from his post at Cambridge in August 1963. But his condition continued to decline. He was diagnosed with end-stage kidney failure in mid-November. He collapsed in his bedroom at 5:30 p.m. on November 22nd, exactly 1 week before his 65th birthday, and died a few minutes later. He was buried in the churchyard of Holy Trinity Church in Headington, Oxford. Media coverage of his death was almost completely overshadowed by the news of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, which occurred on the same day, 55 minutes after Lewis's collapse, as did the death of the English writer Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World. And this coincident loss of three prominent writers on the same day, or leaders, was the inspiration for Peter Kreef's book, Between Heaven and Hell, A Dialogue Somewhere Beyond Death with John F. Kennedy, C.S. Lewis, and Aldous Huxley. If you remember, Peter Kreef was one of my coaches. In 2013, on the 50th anniversary of Lewis's death, Lewis was honored by being included in the Poets' Corner at Westminster Abbey, along with William Shakespeare, Charles Dickens, Thomas Hardy, and some other famous English authors. The floorstone inscription is a quotation from an address by Lewis. "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else." Looking at and along the line. On April 9, 1973, Warney died and was buried in the same grave. There's lots more that can be said about Lewis's life and his writings, and we're coming to the end of our time here. Lewis's last novel, I haven't read it, but hope to, entitled Till We Have Faces, is a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche. It was published in 1956, and Lewis called it far and away my best book, but it wasn't particularly well-reviewed. If you want to go visit the kilns in England, you can. There's a natural reserve behind the house. And the papers and works of his life and the other inklings and all things Lewis are on display there. As we learned in our first session, there are several Lewis societies around the world, including one right here in Beaverton and Corvallis that we can all participate in. So I'll stop there for questions, comments, observations about the man himself. No children. He did take in the three children for a while, and he helped raise Joy Davidson Grisham's two boys, but no, never had children. Diane. Let's see, he was born in 1890, so he would have been in his 60s, I think, late 50s or early 60s, yeah. I think it's interesting, the women in his life. You see what he was attracted to about life, but the stories of what they went through when they were in those vineyard days, it was really horrific. The senior boys treated the younger ones essentially as their slaves and would make them do whatever you can imagine they might. Not much fun. Yes. You know, it's interesting. I listened to a lecture about Lewis and politics and don't remember much. He did have opinions and he had this opinion and that opinion, but I think he assiduously tried not to be identified with a tribe of any kind, a religious group, a political group, a faction. He wanted to try to find a middle ground, the mere Christianity concept, where instead of finding things to argue about, which will take us away from the truth, which will distract us, which will be like the brambles and the thorns that crowd out the true flourishing of the seed, he wanted to help us find that fertile soil where it would grow and flourish, and we could find an association with what we were meant to find, which was that truth, that joy, that essence of being that he was trying to describe and discover. I suspect, if you're like me, that there have been these fleeting moments when everything just seemed to be within your grasp, to be the way it was supposed to be, the way it truly was, not the way it seemed or appeared to be, like Plato calls shadows in a cave, that in the Shadowlands is taken from that idea that we live in the Shadowlands. This is not the real world. This is the earthly world we live in. And our Christian faith teaches us that we have a kind of job to do, that we're ordained to do. If we're not ordained into the faith, if we're ordained into marriage, or if we're ordained in a different way, we're to do what we're called to do, to know and love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves, and to bloom where we're planted doing that. And that's what Lewis learned. Through the suffering he went through in school, the loss of his mother, the time in the trenches, he came to find that kind of joy that gave him focus and meaning in life. And then he tried to figure out, how can I share it? And I can share it. I can't teach it the way an ordained priest might, or that his audience really wasn't the scholarly audience, the effete small group. He wanted, just like those people who knew all the hymns, and he wanted to talk to every man. He wanted to talk to the real humanity. And he attempted to do so in a brilliant way through his imaginative writing, where he would get us to get outside of ourselves so we might see the simple, simplistic beauty of it, the way a child might see it, the way you could see it in Narnia. If we have time next time, I'd like to, if you haven't read it, read The Creation of Narnia. It's just beautiful, the way Aslan sings the world into existence. It's just fabulous. Other thoughts, questions, comments? Yeah, it's written about. I mean, they had some disagreements. I think Tolkien was not as famous as Lewis initially. Became more and more famous later in life. He had children and grandchildren, and was pulled into his family life and other life, and the shared vision of wanting to tell imaginative stories to enlighten the world that was the foundation and the promise of the Inklings coming together had largely been realized. And I think there was a drifting apart that occurred not from particular animosity or an aggrieved incident of any kind, but they were both strong, articulate, verbal men who forcefully delivered opinions in ways that can start to brick by brick build walls of separation. And that's my understanding of what happened. But you're right. They did later in life, the kind of friendship they had early on lost a lot of its essence and energy. Right. See, isn't that classic Lewis? I mean, yeah, can't do whatever. Just read the books. That's all I care about. If you go in terms of when they were written, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe came first. But it's not unlike the first episode of Star Wars was episode 4. And then we had 5 and 6. And then we had the prequels, 1, 2, and 3. So I kind of like the idea of reading The Magician's Nephew first, because it explains why the witch is there, how it got there. It tells about the wardrobe. It tells about Narnia in a different kind of way. It functions very well as a prequel. The Magician's Nephew was not as well reviewed as The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's the one that has the most acclaim. And most probably because it's the most obviously Christian and because of the passion story that we focused on last time. And that story is so powerful and so deeply in our culture that it's hard not to focus on that one. I like The Magician's Nephew, and not to take anything away from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I like The Magician's Nephew for the creation story, the parallels between that story and Genesis, the imagining. I mean, we think, well, there was this great big bang, or God created, and then there was and the first day, and the second day, and the third day. It's not as poetic and magical as Aslan singing this world into existence. The other books beside those two, so that's really the only one that's out of order, I think. The Last Battle needs to be the last one because it's the end of Narnia, and Father Time sweeps, Narnia comes to an end. And the characters that make their way to heaven, ever up and ever in, make their way up to heaven. The Prince Caspian stories and the other stories, the boy and his horse, those are wonderful, almost standalone stories that involve Narnia. A lot less Aslan, a lot less the Pevensey children. And they really can be read in the order that they're typically presented. But they could be read out of order, too. I mean, I think Lewis is right. The stories, by reading all the stories and thinking about all the stories, each of the stories is more informed and integrated and meaningful and whole and warm and rich, and you can enthusiastically enjoy them. But, yeah, there's some people that get all worked up over which one comes first and so forth. And I take Lewis's perspective, you know. Who cares? Just read them. April 9th. Oh, that's his brother Warney. That's when Lewis's brother Warney died. April 9, 1973. Yeah. And they're both buried in the same grave. They were so close throughout life. I think he was not alone. I think I'm blocking on her name. Janie's daughter was there with him, I think, but no, I don't know a lot about it. Warney was an unhappy person. He struggled professionally. He struggled with alcohol. I think the happiness in his life was the time he spent with the Inklings and with his brother. And there's a lot of sadness that swirls around him. Rather like, he was the firstborn and rather like his father. His father was a very sad, unsympathetic person. But he filled the house with books. And I think he was actually quite successful in his law practice. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, those are pretty nice looking houses. Lewis. He talks about solitude, and he doesn't talk about other friends. And interestingly, in the early part of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's what would be, in The Magician's Nephew, characteristic of sibling rivalry. There's Diggory and Polly are just squabbling the way boys and girls would at a time like that. She's talking about his dirty face, and he'd been crying and rubbing dirt on his face. Well, my face is better, you know. Anyway, but they become fast friends in his story later in life. There's another character, Eustace Scrub. One of Lewis's, in real life, critics, someone he got into arguments with, his first name was Eustace. And Eustace Scrub is the most offensive, obnoxious, snotty, bratty kid you can possibly imagine. He's just beastly in behavior. And in one of the tales, he becomes a beast. He's transformed into a dragon. And the way Lewis describes that is just wonderful. And then he eventually repents, becomes a real boy like Pinocchio, but he's still a dragon, and he wants to not be a dragon anymore. And he tears and rips at his skin, and he peels off three layers of skin, dragon skin, but he's still a dragon. It all grows back, and he's just in despair. Aslan comes, and with his claw, he cuts so deeply into this skin and peels it away, and he's saved and reborn and comes back to life. That's a wonderful story. I think that's Prince Caspian. I forget which one. I think that's Prince Caspian. Anyway, that's another part that just vividly sticks in my mind. The scenes, the writing, and the creation of these scenes in this imaginative language is what I find so powerful about Lewis's writing. So next time, our last time, we'll try to get to The Magician's Nephew and The Great Divorce. And The Great Divorce is not husband and wife. It's separation between you and God is The Great Divorce. So thank you all. I appreciate your coming.